ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
Flowers don't usually inspire fierce competition.
Unless you're asking Australians to pick their favourites.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Vote now for Australia's favourite at abc.net.au/science.
Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National and at abc.net.au/science.
I've been looking across the ditch, Jerry, and I'm wondering if they've caught this revolving leaders disease. The PM has just survived another leadership challenge.
And in the Pacific Islands Forum, which of course they attend, they're struggling to reach agreement on what to do about that Chinese missile test.
We're checking in on our neighbours on this episode. It's Hamish McDonald here.
And I'm Geraldine Duke. Let's go roaming.
Well, Geraldine, we've got a fair bit to get through to start the week this week because there is, quite a lot going on in our region. And Chris Luxon, the Kiwi PM, has survived another challenge to his leadership, but they've got elections coming up. And I guess the question is whether he's going to survive until
November.
Then. Yeah.
Shades of sitting in London and watching the drama there. Yes. And look, I'm delighted that we're going to be joined by Anna Fifield to wrestle with all of this. She's spent decades reporting all across the world for the Washington Post and the Financial Times. And now this year, she's returned to her native New Zealand. You'll hear that in her voice, very much a Kiwi, writing about international affairs. Hello there. Anna.
Kia ora to you, Geraldine. Very much a Kiwi. And kia ora to you too, Hamish.
I'm sort of curious actually how you're looking at the world now, because you've spent so much of your career writing for these big international titles, and you're now there writing to, I guess, still an international audience, but curiously, quite a lot happening really close to home.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to write much more for a New Zealand audience because there's very little foreign affairs reporting in New Zealand. We don't really have any think tanks, certainly nothing like a Lowy or an Australia Institute here in New Zealand. So I'm trying to write about the world and draw on my experience in Asia and the Middle East and across the place to help New Zealanders make sense of what's going on during this, you know, rapidly changing, crazy environment.
And because we are going to talk a bit about Kiwi domestic politics, I think it is worth noting for listeners how much the New Zealand media has been hollowed out.
Yeah, that's right. There's been so much attrition at the big newspapers, the broadcasters, RNZ, TVNZ. But yeah, our news hub, a whole channel, television news channel just closed its news division. So it's been really noticeable. The number of journalists operating in New Zealand has really declined.
What's it been like then to have a leadership challenge, which looked, I have to say, looked like a typical one from Australia? It was, you know, odd in terms, I suppose, of the way it turned out. But did you find that was engagement with it big or not?
It was a really huge news story here, partly because it was the second one in just about as many months. It's unusual in New Zealand for a coup to take place, or an attempted coup like this to take place. Even more unusual for it to fail. The fact is, you know, the first time they didn't have the numbers, this time they thought they had the numbers, it also failed. So there has been a lot of domestic hubbub here about this intra-party fighting. It's raised a lot of questions about Christopher Luxon's leadership because basically this latest challenge to his leadership came because of his own goals. He keeps putting his foot in his mouth, even with business audiences, and he's supposed to be the CEO prime minister, but just he makes one gaffe after another, has to keep apologising for what he's saying. And I guess the people within his own party thought that they were now finally able to roll him and give themselves a better chance in the lead up to the election, which is November the 7th, but that has failed. And I think he's going to stay there until the election, but we can bet that he is going to continue to make gaffes and mistakes.
Is it that he's the typical story of a businessman who moves into politics and discovers it's a different realm altogether? Or are they sort of gaffes that people have blown out of proportion?
Yeah, I'm curious about that because I thought it was more than gaffes. It was sort of policy being shot from the hip.
It's both. I mean, the lightning rods this time round were, yes, he is a CEO. People thought that he was going to be good for business and in the same mould as John Key was, who had that real popular touch. Christopher Luxon has a habit of speaking management speak. He still talks about boiling the ocean and things like that McKinsey speak that his staffers just can't get out of him. But the most recent gaffes involved him saying that to a business audience and saying to them that they basically needed to grow up and stop depending on the government, which was a really cack-handed message at a time when the economy is in a lot of trouble. These were small businesses, tourism businesses. They weren't big corporates with lots to lean on. He told them they should be using AI, which is tricky if you're a trailer hire company in a provincial New Zealand. So the message just landed really badly. He released a transcript to try to clean up the mess and it just made it worse. So this undermined what is supposed to be his core selling point, that he understands business. The second one was, yes, a throwaway remark that he made on Talkback Radio when he suggested that he would hold a referendum on MMP, our proportional representation system here in New Zealand. He just made this up on the fly, caught all of his MPs unaware. They were left having to try to cover for him, explain with no talking points whatsoever. I mean, it's a big deal. And
that's pretty serious.
And it was fairly targeted at the types of characters that might end up in government. I wonder how that went down with the other members of the coalition that he leads, because the Nationals are in coalition with the ACT Party and New Zealand First. And for listeners unfamiliar with the New Zealand political system, MMP is there. They've effectively got a proportional representation system in the lower house.
So with the ACT Party, it's okay. That's the Libertarian Party. But with New Zealand First, the populist kind of MAGA-like party that has Winston Peters, wily old politician, as its leader, you know, it's kind of open warfare between the two of them now. They are publicly sparring, fighting. Winston Peters just made a very racist remark against a Chinese-born New Zealand MP that would have got him sacked in any other circumstance. But in this case, he holds the coalition together and Luxon was unable to do anything about it.
Okay, well, look, that sounds like a brew that will make your life interesting right up until November. If slightly, you know, unsatisfying.
Drumming up subscribers for Anna Fifield.
Just, I'll tell you one interesting thing, that almost every player in this is called Chris. The Prime Minister's Chris, the coup leader was called Chris, the Chris Pink, then we had a Chris Bishop who was in the running.
The opposition leader
is called Chris. Yeah. Exactly. It feels like we need a politician who's not called Chris to see us
looking for
this.
The non-Chris. Okay, but on a more serious basis, at least I think it's fair to say this, you've also just returned from Suva, Anna, Fiji's capital, for the Pacific Islands Forum Foreign Ministers meeting. Often I think people thought that was about as interesting as watching paint dry, if you know what I mean, in that sort of terrible Australian way. It's really becoming, I think, you tell me if I'm right or wrong, much more, it matters much more, and following it is becoming more interesting.
Yeah, that is true. This was a very tense meeting. It came just 1 month after China launched that nuclear-capable missile into the South Pacific. It landed in the waters off Tuvalu. Obviously, really shocked many countries in the South Pacific who have been developing closer relations with China, but also the fact it landed in a nuclear-free zone. So this was the top agenda item at the foreign ministers' meeting, and Penny Wong and Winston Peters were trying really hard to get the other foreign ministers to sign on to a statement about this missile. Obviously, Australia, New Zealand, the Solomons have all issued their own statements, but getting unanimity around this table proved to be impossible. And that was because Nauru and Kiribati just refused to sign even the weakest of all statements about this missile.
And why is that? Is that because China has successfully won them over?
Well, they didn't say it that way, but yes, China has been really trying hard in recent years to invest a lot of money, build a lot of political ties in these areas. So it looks quite apparent that Chinese diplomatic and financial influence on these countries is winning for them, because these two countries just would not.
I'm really interested in your view, because I think you're a somewhat more objective observer. The narrative we're told in Australia is that Australia, particularly under Penny Wong, has managed to really rebuild a lot of those relationships in the Pacific. Australia's soft diplomacy has been more effective, but also some of the more pointy edge stuff has been advanced further than it had in previous years. What do you think of that narrative? Is it correct? How is Australia's role being viewed in the Pacific at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's partially correct. I think Penny Wong, obviously, and the Australian government has been extremely active and been on this diplomatic blitz across the region, and also notably quite creative in terms of like the NRL tie-up with Papua New Guinea and the things they've been doing there. I think the countries of the Pacific, obviously there are different views across the region, but generally welcome these bigger neighbours paying attention, because they have been neglected for quite some time. And it's only because China came in and started spending all this money and offering all this support that Australia and New Zealand and the United States started properly paying attention and being good neighbours and supportive in the region. So I think there is some truth to that narrative.
But look, what is also interesting, and I think you've written about this and others have as well, is this area that they sit in called the Blue Pacific, which also, strictly speaking, apparently, is sort of an arc that takes in east of Taiwan. And that this whole area has become much more a part of Chinese Coast Guard behaviour, often their old revamped naval vessels, and that it's looking more and more like a blur between sort of maritime law enforcement and yet strategic power enforcement or projection. And from what I read, but I really want you to help me understand it, the Pacific leaders are sort of saying, oh, we really don't want to enter this. We'd prefer this to stay as nice and quiet and neutral as it has been. But do they have that luxury anymore?
I don't think they do. I mean, China is not interested in the Pacific and these nations out of the goodness of its heart, right? It views these very important maritime areas, and we've seen how they've become more and more assertive. And to your point, using the Coast Guard and other commercial vessels to push boundaries across the South China Sea, to water cannon Filipino ships that are out there. So they are really encroaching further and further south. So I think the Pacific is right to be concerned about that.
See, they call it an ocean of peace, don't they? They're very adamant. It's an ocean of peace.
An ocean of peace. I think you call it that too. But the minerals that are under the sea are of great interest to China. I think that's why China was so interested in the Cook Islands last year, signing that security agreement that got New Zealand very upset, because they see this as strategic in terms of being able to get maritime and physical resources in the South Pacific, where they currently have nothing on land.
You're listening to Global Roaming. From ABC Radio National, it's Hamish McDonald here with Geraldine Doogue. Our guest on this episode is Anna Fifield, a New Zealand-based journalist who's covered this region far and wide for decades. Our next stops are going to be Vietnam and North Korea. Anna, the Vietnamese president's been in Australia over the last week and then on to New Zealand. What's going on there?
Yes, well, he arrived on Wednesday night, the same Wednesday that Christopher Luxon just managed to survive that coup attempt. It could have been pretty embarrassing for us to not have a prime minister to meet him. But yes, it's been a real red carpet welcome, not literally, for Tho Lam, the president of Vietnam. He is by far the strongest president or leader that Vietnam has had in decades, and somebody with a very bold vision for what he wants to see Vietnam become. He's been around the region, around the world, in fact, striking agreements with countries like Thailand, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, France, the UK. He's really trying to build a lot of partnerships because he sees the world changing rapidly, that they countries like the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, we can't rely necessarily on America for our defence and China for our economic prosperity for decades to come. So it's really a hedging strategy that I think he's embarked upon. And that's because he wants to see Vietnam continue to grow. And it's really grown astronomically over the past decade.
It certainly has. It's an amazing story. I don't honestly think Australia fully grasped who was here in the country. You know, that he really is a very interesting figure.
Well, just to that point here, I don't know if you saw this week when Anne Webster, the Nationals MP, turned up at Parliament House and asked the journalists what all the Chinese flags were about.
Can any of you tell me why we have the Chinese flag flying?
It's Vietnam.
Oh, Vietnam.
So that was the exchange with Anne Webster, the Nationals MP from Victoria. So it goes to your point about Australia underestimating the Vietnam
story.
I mean,
this man is almost their Deng Xiaoping. That's how I read him. And I confess, I feel I need to know quite a lot more about him. But, you know, I just wondered whether New Zealanders are grasping who's visiting. And even his backstory, you know, he's a real student of European history, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He is. I mean, and he loves fine wine. Apparently, he's a Kenny G fan. I don't know whether you broke out the saxophones for him in Australia. But yes, he is quite a visionary there. And he's laid out a plan for Vietnam to
He's joined the Board of Peace, if I can just, you know.
He's joined the Board of Peace.
He's completely unpredictable to that extent, Donald Trump. Board of Peace to reconstruct Gaza, allegedly.
He didn't pay $1 billion to join, though, either. So he's wily too there. But yeah, he wants Vietnam to become a high-income country, has set lots of goals to have globally competitive conglomerates, to really promote tech. So I think that there will be a lot of exciting things happening in Vietnam over the next few decades.
I suspect we should probably be a little bit cautious about over-egging him in terms of his record. Like, to get some of those arrangements with the Trump administration, they've agreed to a Trump Tower, this huge golf course resort thing that's being built. There has been a fair bit of criticism for the way that's been handled.
I'm not saying he's, you know, he isn't worthy of criticism, but look, when Vietnam decides to get its act together and go for something, I do watch out.
Yeah.
That's the sort of country they are.
Oh, it's an unbelievably impressive place. And I think historically as well, it's sort of interesting to see them maneuver in this, you know, geopolitical contest between the US and China, because actually they've had to be quite transactional. They've had to adapt to these circumstances, not just over decades, but centuries.
And they've got to stop being the factory, you know, because Trump will just lay, as we know, all the tariffs on them, and they've paid a big price.
So should we understand, Anna, these visits to Australia and New Zealand by To Lam in the context of the Trump tariffs, the Freedom Day tariffs, and trying to, I guess, diversify what their trade relationships are?
I think we should probably view it in the frame of Mark Carney's middle powers banding together. Like, he has been smart. He has, you know, sucked up, for want of a better word, to Trump in many ways. His first visit was to Xi Jinping. He knew that he needed to go to China first of all. So he's very pragmatic in with these two big powers, but at the same time really trying to make sure that Vietnam has a lot of middle power friends around the place as well. So I think he's probably being quite realistic with his approach to the various leaders.
Now, I'm super excited that you've nominated an additional topic for discussion on this episode, Anna Fifield, because I reckon there are very few people that know more about the inner workings of the North Korean Kim dynasty than you. You've spent a lot of time reporting on North Korea. You've written books. But you want to talk about his teenage heir.
Yeah, I mean, that's very kind of you to say that, Hamish, but I feel like none of us know anything almost about this about this girl, this teenage girl who was suddenly everywhere at military parades, at banquets, missile launches. So we don't even know her name. We think her name is Kim Ju-ae, and our source on this subject is Dennis Rodman, the basketballer, who held her when she was a baby when he was going to North Korea. But so we think her name is Kim Ju-ae. We think she's about 13 years old. We do know that she is Kim Jong-un's daughter. She's called the dear daughter in the North Korean propaganda. And it really looks like he is grooming her to become his successor, which just seems unfathomable that this patriarchal old regime could tolerate a youngster and a female, of all things, to be its next leader. It's an open question, obviously, whether the kleptocrats and autocrats there will, the old guard would accept her. But I think that Kim Jong-un is really trying to train her to take over this family business, which is running a totalitarian state.
Time will tell, and other cliches we have known.
I think it's such an interesting example of how we glean information about the inner workings of this regime. Because wasn't it you, if I remember correctly, Anna, that established Kim Jong-un's birth date based on a conversation kind of on the other side of the world?
That is right. What a good memory you have, Hamish. Yes, I tracked down Kim Jong-un's aunt, who was the one who had posed as his mother when he went to school in Switzerland. She now lives in the United States, and I found her. And there was a lot of debate about his birthday, but she told me that she was changing his nappies and she remembers exactly the year because she has her own son the exact same age. So yeah, that we have really... Now, more than ever, actually, almost no human intelligence from inside North Korea. It's been completely sealed since COVID, but definitely nothing around the leadership. They keep things very, very tightly held to the extent that when Kim Jong-un travels or anyone in the family travels, they take their own portaloo with them so that they leave no DNA behind. They clean their own hotel rooms. Not a strand of hair remains.
But even though Kim is relatively young, this is not all just a hypothetical question about who succeeds him, because he's known to be quite unhealthy, right? This is a genuine question about succession, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he is in his mid-40s now, but he looks, extremely. You don't need to be a doctor. Yeah, he doesn't look like a picture of health. He's clearly obese. He's seen smoking all the time at these missile launches. So I would say the biggest risk to him, as far as we can tell, is actually his health. But also his own transition to become leader of North Korea was very hurried. His father had a stroke, and suddenly within 2 years, Kim Jong-un had to be rolled out and, you know, promoted up the ranks of the military apparatus, the Workers' Party, and given this sheen of legitimacy. And it was apparently quite a hairy thing, touch and go at the time. So I think he's now grooming his daughter, and maybe she's there rising through the ranks. Maybe it takes 20 or 30 years, but I think he's giving her the best shot she can have of taking over.
Well, look, we have some lovely feedback which is related. We'd like you to hear some of it, Anna, because it's related to New Zealand. This is from Donald Maddock, the Treaty of Waitangi. New Zealand's current coalition has a majority, yet they are passing bills and laws under urgency. Now, is that a term? They are attacking the treaty principles, Maori language, national parks, fisheries and the voting system. I'd be interested to get your views on this. So is there that sense that they're, skidding, as it were, Anna?
Definitely, this coalition, there is a sense that they have been trying to take back some of the progress that New Zealand has made in terms of being a bicultural nation and being properly bicultural. A lot of this has failed. The efforts, the Treaty Principles Bill that they tried to get through Parliament was overwhelmingly rejected and did not go anywhere. That was an attempt to kind of revise the basic understanding, the basic document that is the foundation of New Zealand. So that one was stopped in its tracks. But there have been a lot of other mostly symbolic decisions, like they recently passed a bill making English an official language of New Zealand, which had a lot of people saying, like, really? We have this cost of living crisis. This is what we're expending our energy on, because
so
Māori...
that's identity politics, really.
Exactly, fermenting a culture war ahead of the election. So that went through. But there also have been changes to the way that voting, registration for voting will be carried out this year. There's a cutoff period, a little bit similar to what the Trump administration and Republicans have been doing in the United States, just to make it harder to enroll up on voting day or close to voting day, which disadvantages people who, might be moving or might be at work or poorer or what have you. So this is seen as an effort to stamp out the Māori vote and other left-wing votes.
Another email. Since we go out on Radio Australia, I'm going to ask you to respond to this. John Henry has written in, following an episode recently with Jeremy Dicker, talking about Chinese influence in the Pacific. And John writes, "It reminded me of the disastrous decision made by the government in 2014 to cut funding to Radio Australia. That decision made, I believe, as a business decision, completely overlooked the service that Radio Australia was to remote Australia and to the Indo-Pacific region. The fact that the frequencies once used by Radio Australia in the Pacific region were immediately picked up by the Chinese government indicates that the Chinese understood soft power better than Australia did at the time. Has that made much of a difference? Who's winning the information war in that regard in the Pacific at the moment, Anna?"
Yeah, that's a really good question and a good point from your listener there. I mean, I guess the question is who listens to radio? I think probably a lot. Sorry, no offense. generationally, things that demographics and things have changed the way people consume media. So in the Pacific, you know, Facebook, Viber, there are a lot of kind of social media things that are the way that people get news.
I think
news.
It's still pretty important, Anna. Certainly it is in PNG, surprisingly so.
Okay. Well, then I defer to you on that. I'm sorry.
It is. Actually, it's quite surprising, the resilience of radio.
That's good to hear. But just to the point of China seeing an opportunity and jumping in to fill it, I think that China has really been looking for opportunities like this around the place. And even, you know, you look at the way the Trump administration has cut USAID and pulled back on a lot of development programs and health programs around the world. China was already trying to move into lots of these spaces, and the US has just created a vacuum now, which they are happy to move into. So whether that's information, they've got a lot of state media channels and like multiple languages, Swahili, Asian languages as well, that they can disseminate their message that way. So I think they are looking for opportunities, and sometimes we provide them.
So look, before we let you go, Anna, we haven't done recommendations for a while, and we're going to do a little recommendations, which we always enjoy doing. What have you been enjoying that you might like to suggest to global roaming listeners?
Well, great question. I have been enjoying this book called All Her Lives, which is written by a good friend of mine here in Wellington. Her name is Ingrid Horrocks. It's short stories, and it came out last year, and I read it then and loved it. But this year, it won the biggest literature prize in New Zealand, the first time a short story collection has done that. So it's a story about women and their tales and resilience and strength and the challenges women face. It's a really beautiful tale. And she, I think she's coming to Byron Bay to the book festival soon.
Jerry, what's yours?
Mine is a long series by Tom Hanks. It's actually going out on World War II that's on SBS, which as you know, I love the history of World War II. I'm fascinated because I think it was the biggest thing that has occurred in my lifetime, and it sort of bears rediscovery. He apparently, when he collaborated with Steven Spielberg on Band of Brothers, he apparently became utterly fascinated with the history of World War II, felt it hadn't been sufficiently told. And it's really, I think it's at least a 20-part series. It's a bit like sort of, you know, the magisterial World at War revisited. It's a lot you'll know, but beautiful little vignettes that you won't know, and a very nice voiceover. I think it's terrific.
Haven't you already recommended that?
No, I don't think I have.
Well, I went away and watched it because you recommended it.
To you personally, but I didn't do it on the air.
Listeners will let us know.
I'm pretty sure I didn't.
And I've just been reading Unsettled by Kate Grenville. It's a really interesting sort of personal meditation. It's her own family's story, which I guess in many ways the Secret River was based upon. And she went on a road trip to, I guess, reflect on, think about what her family's contribution was to the dispossession of Aboriginal Australians from not just the Hawkesbury, but the Hunter, and then up into New England. It's, you know, Kate Grenville, obviously incredibly gifted writer, but it's quite a raw account of her own journey through that. So if you've read The Secret River and you loved that, I would recommend this.
Look, I'm terribly embarrassed because I think you might be right. But
I could be wrong, and I can't wait for listeners to let us know.
They will. Anna, thank you very much for coming on the show today. Much appreciated.
It was my pleasure to be here. I'm going to run away and watch that series right now.
See you next time, Anna.
And look, thanks to our producer, Aston Brown, supervising producer, Pat Sunderland, and executive producer, Laura McAuliffe. Tomorrow, we're going to be chatting with journalist Melissa Chan and political satirist Bhattachal. They've both been faced with, I suppose you could say, the sort of pointy end of China's political and artistic repression, and you'll hear their stories. So bye-bye for now, Hamish.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.